And we're rolling.
Good morning, Nashville.
Good morning, everybody.
And Merry Christmas. Happy Advent.
Yes.
I should say, I guess. So we are, again, happy to be with you this morning to bring you your uprising. And we hope this will be a great one, as we are going to be in a bit talking about one of my favorite things at Christmas. And I would imagine it is probably for my co-host, David Ross, as well.
What's that?
And that is music, particularly Christmas music.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, but to get us started before we get into to music, David, what are your favorite Christmas movies?
Ooh, Christmas movies. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All-time favorite, I gotta say, Home Alone.
Okay. Oh, good one. Yes.
Yes. I mean, just excellent. Joe Pesci and classic.
Kevin!
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Also, The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Oh, interesting choice.
Which, I mean, that's like half Christmas movie,
mm-hmm.
half Halloween movie, obviously.
Yeah.
But Tim Burton is a genius, and I never get sick of that movie. I could watch that over and over.
Hmm.
And yeah, just the animation was kind of cutting edge at
the
time.
Who did the score for that? Was it Danny Elfman?
That was Danny Elfman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They always work together, don't they?
Pretty much.
Okay.
I also like the Santa Claus, Tim Allen.
You really have a thing for Tim Allen, don't you?
What do you mean?
Well, I get
nothing
whatever,
weird.
Okay, it's not that there's anything wrong with that. If you,
it's because I used the sound like, bite with the.
Yeah, you've just mentioned him a lot. There's just, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that's like one of the best, I think. And
yes, that is. That's a good one. That's a good one.
He's
Those
hilarious.
Are great movies.
What are yours?
Well, I have a completely different list. Imagine that. You and I having different tastes. I would start with first one for me is one that I can watch and never tire of, and it's not been out too many years, but it's called The Family Stone. I really like movies that are about when Christmas goes awry, and I think that's often what I've experienced in life. And you may want it to be perfect, but
is that a newer?
It's a newer one with Diane Keaton and Claire Danes, Dermot Mulroney, Luke Wilson. Great cast.
Mm.
And it's about this family gathering and getting a chance to meet one of their son's new girlfriend. And actually, he's like getting ready to pop the question. And let's just say that things don't go over really well with the family and meeting her, and it's very uncomfortable, but yet it's so very real, I think, when we're dealing with family stuff. So I love that movie. Another one I love is Love Actually, because
I've seen it.
You have?
I've seen most of it.
It's probably more the chick flick of maybe Christmas. I think a lot of women really like Love Actually.
That's like, it's like a star-studded movie. Like there's so many
British
celebs
film
in.
That is, I like it because it does have so many different vignettes to it. And, you know, in the love in question, it's not all romantic love. Like one of the stories is about a woman's love for her brother who has special needs, and, you know, how that sometimes has presented hardships in her life, but yet it's love, and it's something that she chooses him over others in her life and the sacrifices that she makes.
Nice.
You know, for him. It's very real to me. So Love
cool.
Actually. And the last one is one that I often watch on Christmas Day. It's oft debated as to whether this is actually a Christmas film. I think you know what's coming. Yes, it's Die Hard.
Yes.
And yes, I do believe that it is a Christmas movie. It is a film about the night that Bruce Willis' character, John McClane, makes it to California, to I think it's Los Angeles, but to visit his estranged wife, Holly, and trying to work things out with her. And she is working at the Nakatomi Building, and They are taken hostage that night by one of the best villains of all time, Hans Gruber, played by the late, great Alan Rickman. Just an awesome, awesome movie, and I do think it's a Christmas movie.
I think we should poll the audience on this one. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? Send us an email, NashvilleUprising@gmail.com.
You know it is, Nashville. We want to hear from you. So what we thought we would do for you today is we want to share some stories about the background, the history, origins of some of our favorite Christmas carols and Christmas songs. And I have the first up is Silent Night. And believe it or not, there is a kind of, I think, a tie-in to Die Hard, one of my favorite Christmas movies. So if you just sit back and maybe light a candle, we've got some candles going here in the studio, and pour yourself another cup of coffee and
or eggnog,
yeah. and listen, I think you'll get a lot out of these stories. It was actually the year 1818, Christmas Eve, to be exact. And it was a night when the unexpected happened. Joseph Moore was the curate or the pastor of the St. Nicholas Parish Church in Oberndorf, Germany. You don't get a much better name for a church at Christmas time than St. Nicholas. And I know as a pastor, one of the things that I hate it when it happens is that you get a curveball thrown at you on one of the most important days or nights of the church year. And so it was on that night that Joseph Moore discovered that the organ wasn't working. In some stories, it said that church mice had made their way into the organ and were hungry church mice and done some chewing. And others say that it was just the elements and there was some rust that had taken place. But nonetheless, the organ was no longer working. And there was a fear that it truly would be a silent night that Christmas Eve in Oberndorf, Germany. But it just so happened that Joseph Moore was a poet as well as a pastor. And he had written some words years before, penned some verses that he thought might make a good tune for Christmas. And so he enlisted the help of his church musician, his organist, whose name was Franz Gruber. Not to be confused with Hans Gruber, the villain of Die Hard, but instead, wonderful, wonderful man. And boy, you're lucky when you get a great church musician. I know, because my co-host is one. And so we have Franz Gruber, who, if you're really fortunate, you'll have a musician who can play several instruments. And it so happened that Franz did. And so he took the verses that his friend, co-worker Joseph gave to him, and he penned a tune on the spur of the moment that could be easily accompanied on guitar. And thus, the threat of that silent night in 1818 on Christmas Eve was averted. And those words to Silent Night, when all is calm, all is bright, round yon virgin, mother and child, holy infant so tender and mild, sleep in heavenly peace. Sleep in heavenly peace. It is one of the most translated Christmas carols in the world. I would imagine that there was no way that this small town poet and his musician would have ever imagined that they had so quickly penned, you know, a tune that would touch so many lives. In fact, Silent Night has a bit of magic to it. It is known, according to many stories, to have even caused ceasefires during both world wars, on Christmas Eve in World War I and World War II, it is said that the soldiers put down their weapons and they lit candles and they sang Silent Night or Stille Nacht, as it was originally penned in German. They sung it together in their respective languages, and for a while there was peace on earth and goodwill to men.
That was a good story.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, that was like one of the first co-writes.
Yep.
You have a lyricist,
yes.
A poet, and
uh-huh.
Was he a musician as well? Or he was mostly just a poet?
Mostly just a poet. And
so he needed a
parish priest of the town. And
needed a musician at the last minute, too.
Yeah.
Sometimes urgency brings out your most creative moments.
It's interesting too that through the decades and centuries that like Franz Gruber has been a little bit lost to time, because apparently there's different legends that attributed the tune to Mendelssohn and different really well known composers, but it was Franz Gruber.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I remember reading more. The guy that wrote the lyrics, he died like broke and didn't make a dime off of it. And this is like before the age of any real music business or copyright laws existed. And it's just crazy to think that. But that's how
it goes. One of the
most
sung songs at Christmas. I would say, as I've mentioned in a previous episode, that pretty much most Christmas Eve services close with Silent Night all over the world. So it's pretty amazing.
So moving on here.
What do you have for us, David?
One of my favorite carols is O Holy Night. And not for any real reason except just as a musician, like I love good chord progressions and good melodies, of course, but there's something about O Holy Night. It's just unlike other carols, and it's a constant build towards this huge moment in the song, and it just moves me, and there's been so many good versions of it, and so
I thought I'd
go back and look at the origins of O Holy Night. The story of O Holy Night begins in France in the mid-1800s. But this song would eventually make its way around the world. It would also mark a technological revolution that would forever change the way people were introduced to music. Placide Capot was the commissioner of wines in a small French town. He's known for his poetry writing, and the priest of his church requested he pen a poem for their Christmas mass. Now, Capot wasn't exactly an avid churchgoer, but he accepted the request. He broke out his Bible for inspiration, and he used the Gospel of Luke to guide him. And before long, he arrived in Paris with this completed work. It was a poem titled Cantique de Noël. And he was moved by his work, and he realized it needed something more. Yes, it needed music from a master musician's hand. And so he turned to his friend Adolf Charles Adams for help. And Adolf was an educated, seasoned musician, having written for several operas and ballets around the world. He was really quite famous. Now, Adolf was a man of Jewish ancestry, but in the name of a strong friendship with Capot, he delivered an original score to go with the poem. And Cantique de Noël was performed 3 weeks later at a Christmas mass, and it was wholeheartedly accepted in the Church of France, quickly finding its way into Christmas services all over. But then something happened. Placide Capot walked away from the church and he joined the socialist movement. And church leaders discovered that Adolf Adams was actually Jewish. And all of a sudden, this beautiful song was uniformly denounced by the church. And even though the church, they tried to bury this masterpiece, the French people continued singing it. It was an American writer who would bring it to a new audience a decade later. That writer was John Sullivan Dwight. hailing from Boston, he had a publication of his own called Dwight's Journal of Music. It had quite a big following in the Northeast among music lovers, and he needed some new material to review, so he chose, you guessed it, Cantique de Noël. And he fell in love with the lyrics. See, Dwight was an ardent abolitionist, and so he identified with the following lyrics. Truly he taught us to love one another. His law is love, and his gospel is peace. Chains shall he break, for the slave is our brother, and in his name all oppression shall cease. And he felt that this song, this poem, it needed to be shared with Americans, and so Dwight published an English translation of Cantique de Noël titled O Holy Night. And it spread, and it became popular in America, especially in the North, during the Civil War. Fast forward to 1906, on Christmas Eve, a guy named Reginald Fessenden. He was a university professor and also the former chief chemist for Thomas Edison, and he did something many thought to be impossible. Fessenden spoke into a microphone, and for the first time in history, a human voice was broadcast over the airwaves. And he read scripture, and he put on a sort of Christmas program, being that it was Christmas Eve. Surely he dazzled radio operators on ships across the Atlantic and Caribbean seas as their normal coded impulses were interrupted by this professor, a human voice reading from the Gospel of Luke. It must have seemed like a Christmas miracle of sorts. Fessenden finished his recitation of the birth of Christ, and then he picked up his violin, and right into the microphone, he played O Holy Night, the first song ever to be sent through the airwaves. So that is the story of O Holy Night, and I think it's so cool, like, how far these songs come from, like, geographically, and the crossing language barriers and borders, and like from this, like it started in France and came to Boston and broadcast over the first radio broadcast, and like what a journey for a song.
Well, and I'm interested in at some point that it was, you know, deemed as not appropriate because of, you know, Jewish background and socialism and other things. It's had quite a storied, long route to get to where we are. And I hope that we will be hearing O Holy Night for our music program next Sunday night, Light for the Longest Night, that we'll be doing at 7 o'clock. So I know I'm looking forward to hearing O Holy Night. So
yeah.
Well, that brings us to my next stories. I'm actually going to tell stories of two pretty well-known pieces, songs that I know at least one of them always makes it into our repertoire at Christmas time of Christmas carols. And the other one is one that I'm sure we often hear on the radio. We may not sing it as often in church services, but it is well-known. And I decided to group them together because they really have kind of a similar background. And so
nice.
I'll share with you the...
A twofer.
That's
right.
I like it. So I'm going to start with the story of It Came Upon the Midnight Clear. It was written in 1849. And like Silent Night, it was written by a Unitarian minister named Edmund Sears. But it arose from a period of darkness. And I think at Christmas time, these songs speak so much to us because they do speak out of pain and to our pain, to our longings, to our need for hope and peace at Christmas time, the peace that only the Christ child can bring to us. So Edmund Sears, after a time of illness and depression, he decided to write a song that would also come out of a period of national strife as the country was getting over a war and was also in a time, a buildup to what would become one of the greatest conflicts this country has ever known. There were so many skirmishes and fights and debates that were taking place about slavery. But in 1849, he penned It Came Upon the Midnight Clear. And one of the verses that he wrote has been one that I find one of the most theologically rich of any Christmas carol, where he says, "O ye beneath life's crushing load, whose forms are bending low, who toil along the climbing way with painful steps and slow, look now for glad and golden hours, come swiftly on the wing, O rest beside the weary road, and hear the angels sing." I wonder if those words, penned in 1849, ever spoke to the great poet who wrote the words of another beloved Christmas carol. And that poet was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, one of the most esteemed American poets. He too lived and wrote during a period of great upheaval. For he wrote his Christmas classic on Christmas Day in 1863. It came out of a time of great pain and great grief, both for the country and also for the Longfellow family personally. It was 2 years previously that Henry's beloved wife, Fanny, while she was believed to have been working on a scrapbook by candlelight, she had her dress catch fire, and she tragically died of her injuries. Henry heard her cry out, and he had been taking a nap, and he rushed into the room, and he tried to put out the flames with a rug and then with his own body, and he suffered horrible burns himself. And it was said that he later sported his long white wig because his face was so burned by the flames that took his Fanny from him. He was racked with grief for years at her loss, and he also suffered the pain of seeing his eldest son, his 18-year-old beloved Charlie, go off to fight for the Union Army in the Civil War. Charlie had several different injuries during battle, but one came to him also in 1863, and he was nearly paralyzed by a bullet. He came home, and he was recuperating at home, and it just so happened, as poets do, that Longfellow sat down on that Christmas Day of 1863, and he decided to pen his Christmas classic, I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day. And so those words were ones that I think speak not only of what he was going through personally, but also with what was happening between the North and the South. Now, as is often the case, Christmas carols and Christmas songs, as often do hymns, have many verses that we may be unaware of. I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day is one of those. There is actually a verse that goes like this. It was as if an earthquake rent the hearthstone of a continent and made forlorn the households born of peace on earth, goodwill to men. And after the verse that speaks to what the nation is suffering, we have what I consider, and I think many who love this song consider, the really strong refutation that evil or darkness or pain or misery will have the last word. Because Longfellow was able, out of his own grief and despair, to write these words. "And in despair I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said, for hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men. But then pealed the bells more loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. the wrong shall fail and the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men. I just find it so fascinating that out of times of great pain and hardship and suffering, that the God Spirit can move to create just this incredible body of art that touches lives all over the world. And the threads that are similar in those two songs just really touched me. And I don't know if you found some of that as well, David, in some of your research on Christmas music.
Yeah. No, a lot of these songs are just born out of pain and suffering, as is a lot of great art. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to keep chugging along here. I have one more story to share with you, and kind of like the stories you've been telling, Christy, it's a tale, tale of a song born out of loss and suffering. And this is one of her most beloved Christmas songs, especially for kids. I think you're going to like this story. The year was 1938, and Bob May was looking toward another bleak Christmas. May was a writer with dreams of writing the great American novel. But as life would have it, he was a copywriter for Montgomery Ward's. That was a retailer that was only second to Sears at the time. And he earned a meager salary, and he was on the brink of bankruptcy, basically. And he was also losing his wife, Evelyn, to cancer, which she had been battling for 2 years. A manager at Montgomery Ward's decided to create its own children's book for their annual holiday promotion. They asked Bob May to take a crack at it, and so he did. And for inspiration, Bob reflected on his childhood, an upbringing that carried a good deal of pain. See, Bob had been a small, thin child, constantly picked on by other kids. His two sisters often had to stand up for him. Even in college, he was so slightly built, he was often mistaken for a boy. He was also inspired by his 4-year-old daughter, Barbara, and she wondered why her sick, dying mother wasn't like everyone else's mommy. So drawing on these tough life experiences, he made up a story about a reindeer named Rudolph who had a large, bright red nose. It was a tale of the pain felt from being different, but also the joy experienced from finding your special place in the world. So he handed in this story to his boss, who was not initially impressed, but they moved forward with the project anyway. A few months later, May's wife passed away. His boss offered to take May off the Rudolph project in his time of grief, but he refused. Bob May would later say, "I needed Rudolph now more than ever." And the book was a hit. Montgomery Ward's printed and distributed more than 2 million copies that year at branches across the country. All the while Rudolph was blowing up, Bob May's then CEO, Stuwell Avery, for reasons unknown, released the rights to Rudolph back to May. If there was a time for May's luck to change, this would be it. May had a brother-in-law, Johnny Marks, who was a songwriter, and he hadn't made it big yet, but he was working on it. May talked him into writing a song about Rudolph. And that song eventually got picked up by none other than singing cowboy Gene Autry. It sold more than 25 million copies and paved the way for the classic stop animation film that we all remember and love. So Bob May remarried, and he had a growing family. And thanks to Rudolph, they were taken care of financially through the end of his life and beyond. So surely one could say that Bob May, like his Rudolph, turned weakness into strength and found his special place in the world. So that was the story of Rudolph, and we're out of time, unfortunately.
Always goes too fast.
Hope you've enjoyed these stories.
They've been really interesting. I've learned a lot.
Me too.
We hope you've enjoyed the Nashville. How can our listeners find us, David?
You can find past episodes of Uprising on iTunes and Podomatic by searching Bellevue Presbyterian Uprising.
And please, you can also find us live and in person at Bellevue Presbyterian Church. We'll be there at 10:30 for worship this morning. And we particularly invite you on the 17th for Light for the Longest Night at 7 p.m.
Yes. Merry Christmas and peace out.
Yippee-ki-yay. And to all a good night.
Nice.
Bye-bye.